now, Rick, if you could take me out of there, please. Last week, as we wrapped up Mark chapter 1, we saw Jesus' ministry just naturally overflowing into healings and exorcism as the one who constitutes the kingdom of God that we hope for poured out that nature around him. And what we saw was Mark deliberately bringing us back to the importance. See it first in the example of Christ who's out praying, God praying to God out in the wilderness to be alone with him, to be in private and personal relationship. And then by the end of the chapter, we see the crowds going back out to Christ to find God in the same, and it's the same word, lonely places, indicating the importance of this personal relationship. But of course, that passage at the same time did not discount the importance of God's people, the group in the life of faith. And as one example, Jesus heals a leper, indicating God's willingness to restore to spiritual cleanness, to fellowship with him, any individual found in any condition who is willing to be healed. And immediately sends this leper to fulfill the law of Moses, which is to go back to interceding and mediating their return to the people before the Lord. And then, of course, the passage ends with the leper's careless preaching. Christ commanding him to go quietly to the priests so he might testify to them. Instead, and I think the word is not an accident at all by Mark, it says that he went about carelessly preaching. It's this word kerygma, which will be associated with the gospel preaching of the apostles, that he takes upon himself and appoints himself to be the judge of what he will teach and to whom, causing serious issues in the ministry of Christ and in reaching the priests themselves whom he was meant to testify to. We pick back up in chapter 2, and let's read the first five verses together again. A few days later, when Jesus again entered Capernaum, the people heard that he had come home. They gathered in such large numbers there was no room to him, a paralyzed man, carried by four of them. Since they could not get him to Jesus because of the crowd, they made an opening in the roof above Jesus by digging through it and then lowering the mat the man was lying on. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralyzed man, "Son, your sins are forgiven." Well, once again, something we are always seeing in the Gospels is that there was a very significant stirring in Galilee and Judea around Christ. It was affecting the whole population in one way or another, and that's what's happening again in Capernaum, Jesus' hometown here. But we should remind ourselves yet again, as the Gospels commonly will, that numbers do not indicate sincerity of faith or sincerity of response. Again, we'll remember in John chapter 6, Jesus will go out of his way to make this point with a crowd that follows him, and he charges them, saying, "You have them with teachings that are difficult to understand. They all but the apostles abandon him." This holds true to this day. Popularity or numbers in no way, and I mean no way, indicate a movement of God. None at all. The English-speaking word, and this was centered in America, the Eastern Coast, New England district, experienced 160 years ago or more what's often referred to as the Second Great Awakening, one of two incredible revivals to hit the English-speaking word. And the man who was in charge of this, who was more than anyone and unquestionably the focal point of this revival, was a man named Charles Finney. And to help you understand how little revival, as it appears to us, might actually indicate new life, Finney, in his own words, was very clear as he talked or miraculous about human conversion. This was a linchpin to his ministry teaching. There is nothing spiritual about the conversions that are happening around me. He described it instead as a purely philosophical result, purely philosophical, of the right use of the constituted means. In other words, conversion could be engineered through psychology. That's what he believed. It was not the measure of his ministry in his own eyes. And he went on to explain the means, the constituted means that he used. And so here are four of them, though there are more. His first was to create an atmosphere, particularly through music, that prepared people for psychological pressure. Then apply psychological pressure. Step two, he famously preached, pulling them out and pressuring them to make a response that you want them to make. Then make an altar call. That's all part of step two. Finney then went on to say you should target the wealthy and the influential in particular in hopes that other people will follow. Again, a philosophical, psychological means to produce numbers. And then, importantly, he said that the means of applying this psychological pressure was to prolong everything you could. Make the songs as long as possible. Make each meeting as long as possible. Make the meetings as a whole go on for weeks and weeks to maximize your engineering of these people's response. That was how Charles Finney, the linchpin, the head of the Second Great Awakening, described God's movement in his time. Now, he went on to measure real change and nothing. He was engineering an atmosphere to produce conversions that were in no way miraculous. The same things happen all the time today, whether people know it or not. It is not by numbers that you can ever tell whether the Spirit of God is really moving. There is only ever one measure in the church. Is it bearing the fruit of the Spirit? And you could say of Charles Finney's ministry and Jonathan Edwards before it, you can say of later ones like Billy Graham's and others, that good fruit did come. But it was not the numbers that indicated any of that. It was the fruit itself which stood the test of time. So Finney viewed in his summary that conversion was not spiritual or philosophical. The numbers did not indicate anything. They were just a hope that in something a little bit better than what Charles Finney left us. What else do we see in this passage so far? Number one, we see the virtue of perseverance and determination. This is something that Christ regularly recognizes and acknowledges with those who come to him. He values perseverance and determination. When there was no easy way into this house, these four men, I have to imagine they were young men to be so bold, but who knows? They were going to find a way for their friend to meet Christ. And Christ values it. He sees their faith and acknowledges this virtue within them. And I wonder today how you might be encouraged to the same perseverance and determination, how you might apply perseverance and determination to your situation. This example also demonstrates something that I've commonly drawn to your attention as we've gone through the scriptures. That while salvation is something personal, I've said it even here to this morning, it is not something that we achieve alone. Once again, our attention is drawn to friends who bring this person to salvation. Friends who, in the first part, I want us to notice yet again, are bold, and resourceful and deliberate, who are, in fact, shamelessly willing to pursue what their friend needs if he needs it. You need friends like that in your life. Another gospel tells us that when this man was lowered, they actually had to go and tie ropes to the man. I mean, they were up on this roof for a while to lower him in. But how Mark portrays Jesus' response is that Mark saw their faith. Now, it is plural. You might think, well, he's speaking about the man on the mat. But everything we've read so far has made the agents and the centers of attention the friends, not the man on the mat. Jesus sees their faith, the friend's faith, And we must assume that the one on the mat also had it. But Mark is trying to draw out the importance of these friends and their work in this man's life to bringing him to forgiveness. Their faith was the master's response. What does that mean for you and me? Well, we each must personally embrace the faith of our friends. Maybe it belongs to our family. Maybe it's of our mentor, our hero, whoever it is. But we are never. The faith of those around us is not ultimate in determining our place with the Lord, but it's also not trivial. Time and time again, the scriptures testify to. It is not trivial. And that means a couple of things: that we really need to value the people around us in our salvation, because they are the means through whom it has come to us. Whether they're the person who first preached the gospel to you and you believed, or the person who has continued to support you in the faith and to turn you back and to awaken you when you're sleeping. But on the other hand, it means we must not abdicate our effect on others or underestimate the importance of our role in the lives of those around us. Paul was very clear when he preached about his own ministry, that he strove so far hard so that by some means, he says, I might save some. Oh, well, wait a second, Paul. Don't you mean Jesus might save some? We should never say we save anyone. I don't mean that in the ultimate sense. I didn't die on the cross. I was not the one who resurrected himself. I am not the center of a faith. But I am not trivial in all of those who will enter the kingdom because of my ministry. The Lord worked through someone, me, and it mattered. And I must continue to work so his salvation can come to others. This is in complete continuity with what we read here this morning. But I'd like us to reflect for just a moment on what the nature of this faith was for these men. We're about to see a prime example of Christ claiming that he is more than human, that he's in fact divine. What will be crystallized in later theology with terminology like the Trinity, fully God and fully man. Do these men know anything about that at this time? They don't. They don't know precisely who this is who's come to them or how. And that really matters. Because again, it hits the nail on the head that the faith that we are about is Jesus. You can live your entire life accepting all of the doctrines of the church and all of the further clarifications of what we mean in our theology. You can accept them all and be a part of the club, but if you don't have faith in the person of Jesus as the cornerstone of your life, you have nothing. Nothing at all. And on the other hand, men like these who had so little understanding of Christ, but knew in him is found life, they have everything. Now, I'd warn you, as I always do, that doesn't mean we reduce ourselves to essentialism and say, well, as long as you've got these facts straight, you're completely healthy. That's not true. You and I live in a privileged age where we have so much access to the truth about Christ. But nevertheless, we should never look down on those who are small in faith, who know little but love greatly. And if that's the nature of your faith, continue on in it boldly. This is the Christian faith. It's about Christ. Finally, for this passage, what do we see about the character of Jesus from this example? We see how eager he is to forgive sin. He leaps at the opportunity. He's like the father in the prodigal son parable who rushes out. Is this an opportunity to forgive? I forgive. Nobody has come here asking for forgiveness of sins. And his immediate response in seeing their faith is, forget about the healing for now. I forgive your sin. You are forgiven. You are cleansed. You are restored. This is what Jesus has come to do in Israel and from Israel to the rest of the world. These men come for a physical healing because the one in whom they trust, they know he can do it. And he offers a new spiritual life instead. He drives them to have their attention on the real need. And while he is going to pour out the physical healing, he makes adamantly clear what is most important in their lives. Let's go on to the next two verses. Now, some teachers of the law were sitting there thinking to themselves, "Why does this fellow talk like that? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God?" Well, this is our first run-in with the teachers of the law, and a few verses later, it'll become clear that this includes the Pharisees. And the other gospel writers also point out and just name the Pharisees from the start. I thought we should spend a few minutes talking about the Pharisees because we're going to run into them regularly, and included with them as a branch both of Pharisees. Who were the Pharisees? Well, they were a school of laymen. Very few of them were priests. In fact, the teaching Pharisees, you might be a priest who came under Pharisees, but the teaching Pharisees were all non-priests living in the Jewish world. They had enormous influence on the popular crowd in Judea and even in Galilee and beyond in the broader diaspora. They had virtual complete control over the synagogues. And they enjoyed official positions within Israel, like the Sanhedrin, which was the ruling 70 elders of this people, through whom Rome preferred to have them ruled. Many Pharisees make up that body, as well as Sadducees and a couple of other sectarian members. Their influence was a mix of good and not impossible to be a Pharisee and come to Jesus. Others are a little more ambiguous in the scriptures, though history remembers them to eventually receive Christ, like Gamaliel, who was the teacher of the Apostle Paul, and who's pictured very well in Acts as an even-handed and fair-minded individual who treats the apostles well. They are the people who trained and then commissioned Paul in his original work as a teacher of the law. And they taught him a great deal of truth that not all of the Jewish people held to, particularly the Sadducees. Because of the Pharisaical influence, Paul came to believe that all of the Old Testament was inspired by God, while other groups, like the Sadducees I've already named, believed only Moses or other parts were inspired by God. One of the really distinct features about the Pharisees' belief is they believed in the resurrection of the dead to come. Trial, saying to his fellow Pharisees who are about to judge him, "I'm being persecuted because of my faith in the resurrection." Now, he didn't exactly say the resurrection of Jesus, but this was common ground. Meanwhile, there are other parts of Pharisaical teaching we'll get to today that we would find abominable. One of the main schools of thought at the time of Jesus, for example, taught that a man can divorce his wife for any wish whatsoever, whether it's because he just has a passing moment of anger at her or he's found someone he likes more. He is free to divorce and remarry at will as many times as he wants in his life. So hardly a completely reliable tradition. We can say that coming out of the Babylonian exile, the Pharisees were a part of this renewed emphasis on understanding the law and following it so they could faithfully walk in the covenant God had given them. But they're at the same time showing how a dark heart can darken even the word of God. In Romans 11, Paul refers to his people who are perishing, his fellow kinsmen, descendants of Abraham, and he explains ultimately why this happened. It's such a strange thing that the Jews who for so many years, and here he's thinking primarily of groups like the Sadducees and Pharisees and their influence among his people, who for so many generations had pursued the law are not receiving the reward, while, he says, Gentiles who never pursued the law are. Why is this? And he gives his answer. It's because they pursued the law not by faith, but by works. Legalism. And we should be careful what we mean by legalism. We don't mean legalism is teaching people to obey, as if the commandments of God are a burden that... No, that's not what legalism is. Legalism is trusting in technicalities. It's mounting law upon law, thinking the law itself is what saves. Some externality, some keeping of a rule, even some bending of the rule is fine, without the heart of faith. That's what Paul bemoaned among his people. These individuals, including the Pharisees and their influence, ultimately pursued the law as if it was a matter of externalities or nationalism, but not of love for God. These Pharisees held a great deal of moral authority in their own eyes and in the eyes of many in the Jewish nation. They thought that they were the rule for right and wrong, even though they couldn't agree among themselves. The preparation for the Christ. And we might add on that note of moral authority that they also are constantly being targeted by Christ for their lack of mercy towards sinners. The parable of the prodigal son is an excellent example. That parable involves a sinner coming back to the Lord, but that's not what it's about. That's not at all what that parable is about. It's about once that sinner comes back, the brother who never left won't accept him. Speaking straight to the hearts of the Pharisees. Because they taught and believed that if Israel for just one day would completely refrain from sin, the Messiah would come. That's all they were waiting on, was one day without sin. If we could just have that one day. And so who is the problem in Israel if Messiah hasn't come? Well, it's the tax collectors and the prostitutes and all of those sinners, all of those people who share the cause of all their problems. Now, we talk about this at length because there is relevance today to how we're supposed to think of ourselves, along with those of Abraham's descent who share our human nature. And I want you to listen to the end of this without drawing conclusions until we get to two points that absolutely every Christian should be able to say about our relationship with the descendants of Abraham today and our responsibility towards them. The Pharisees are the ones who persecuted the church. And in fact, in certain parts of the world, their descendants, the rabbis, continue to do that today. It does happen. They were part of the leaders who persuaded Rome to crucify Christ at great effort. They are the ones who commissioned Paul and who, among whose number, in the earliest martyr stories, they are the individuals, like in Polycarp's martyrdom, who go to the Roman authorities trying to have the saints killed, which happens on numerous occasions. And the point of this is that the religion that developed, the religion that Jesus is facing in his day, cannot be brought to reconciliation with the Christian faith. The religion, not the people, the religion. The result of these very Pharisees, of the seeds that they planted among their people, is today's rabbinic Judaism. And rabbinic Judaism, well, let's put it this way. Their main explanation for their own doctrine to this day is a lens that they place on the Old Testament consisting of oral tradition. Parts all the way from Moses in order to understand the Old Testament. It's oral tradition that is authoritative. That oral tradition was written down in the Talmud, which consists of the Mishnah and Gemara. And though parts of this were written down before Christ, it was compiled well after him, and many parts are a deliberate response to reject him. In the year 90 AD, 20 years after the Jerusalem temple had been destroyed, and about 60 years after Christ had died and been resurrected, the Pharisees, now often calling themselves rabbis, held a council at Jamnia, which changed the course of the faith to this day, which instituted this oral tradition, which affected what used to be a very diverse Judaism into really only one form. When I was a student almost 20 years ago, endless Orthodox Jewish scholars from Jerusalem's Hebrew University to New York to all over the Western world, claiming that the faith they hold to in many of its practices, in its present translations, because immediately after Christ, the rabbis went about retranslating their Greek and Hebrew scriptures to rule out that Christ could be the Messiah. All of these modern scholars finally testifying to what the early church said, that a new faith was born in Israel that was not like the old one, intentionally intended to reject Christ as Savior. A younger faith, you might say, than Christianity. And so Jews for Jew prostitute, it teaches that he was born of adultery. It teaches that he's an evil man. It calls him a magician numerous times, a sorcerer, and a fool. It says he was a deceitful man whose life was cursed by God and cut short because of it. And it claims that our blessed Lord to this day is burning in hell, boiling forever in excrement. This is not how the entire faith was in Jesus' day. There was a great deal of diversity, especially in the years beforehand, that were wondering aloud, why do we see what appears to be more than one God in our Old Testament? What are we supposed to do with these two powers in heaven that responded with faith when Christ claimed lordship and to be divine? But these are the seeds that Jesus and his followers are facing in the first generation of the church among the Pharisees. His people's past, that there have always been two children of the nation. Some are the children of Hagar who are born by natural means, and they persecute the son born according to the power of the Spirit who received the promise. And he concludes, the slave woman's son, that is natural Israel that will not receive Christ, will never share in the inheritance with the free woman's son. Our response today should still be governed by the Apostle Paul and the other apostles and our scriptures. There are always extremes. It seems like there's always poles about how the church should respond to the Jewish faith of their time. Some respond with hate, and they reject and want to destroy, and they even put a mindset onto God that he is furious and trying to hurt the nation, which couldn't be further from the truth. You don't have to worry. God's going to save everybody. You'll be okay. And that is not the apostles' perspective in the least bit for his own people. Do we really care for the salvation of the people of Abraham's line like Paul did? Do we care enough to accept that things are not okay and yet not rush into vindictiveness or harm, but intercessory prayer and the patient preaching of the gospel? If we belong to either of these poles, either the ones that utterly reject or the ones that unconditionally accept, we have nothing to do with the apostles' faith. We are not joining him in his heart for his kinspeople. Romans 9 through 11, Paul gives his most extended explanation of how we ought to act instead. He observes, "And I believe." Yet Paul sees a real problem. He says, I would give my own salvation up for this people if I could. If I could bring them to faith, to participate in the kingdom in which I hope, I would give up my place in that kingdom. You don't say that unless it's clear in your mind that they are perishing. And clear equally in your mind that we should care. And this is the problem with what is sometimes called replacement theology, which sees the Jewish plight today as hopeless. I'll go over that very quickly. Replacement theology teaches that there are two people God has had. He had the nation of Israel, and when they rejected Christ, God utterly rejected them as a nation. He's done. And replaced them with the nations, you and me, the church. And there is very little hope that anyone of Jewish background will be, which has grown enormously since the 1830s, which also posits that God has had two people. Israel was rejected for a time. It was put on hold. Still God's people, but not actively being treated that way while the nations are reached in the church. But one day when the church is removed, God will resume his salvation of Israel at that time. And the last one doesn't really have a name. We might call it the classic or traditional understanding because it was by far the primary one up to our age. It's the original Baptist understanding, though today I don't know which is more popular, dispensationalism or the classic tradition. But it does not accept that there have been two people at all, ever. It does not accept that the nation of Israel was ever rejected. It never was. Not temporarily, not permanently, and it doesn't accept that anybody's ever been judged. In other passages, it seeks to use the same language that the Apostle Paul used. He describes Israel as a tree, and individuals from that tree, individual branches, have been pruned out because of a lack of faith, while wild shoots from the nations are grafted in. But it comes with a strong warning that if the natural branches could be cut off, so can you so easily for unbelief. And it understands that faith, not birth, has always defined God's people. After all, in the Old Testament, no matter who you were born to, if you rejected the law, would you get to participate in Abraham's promises? No. You'd be removed from the land, either through exile or execution. And if you were an outsider, was it hopeless for you to ever participate in Abraham's promises? No. Kenizzites, and at some point we don't hear about, enters in. He becomes central to the nation, one of only two faithful witnesses that survived his generation to enter the promised land. A foreigner and one born to the family, Joshua and Caleb. Or Rahab, who though she was born to the Canaanites, received the fear of God and entered the people and became a great grandmother of the Christ himself. That position agrees with the dispensational position that God will recover even the physical line of Israel at some point in time. Now, I don't believe that replacement theology, at least in the forms that I've faced it, can explain the scriptures. What does Paul go on to say, even to this day, of those who have been trained under this Pharisaical influence, modern rabbinic Judaism, on recovery? It's not absolute. There is possibility and hope for salvation. He says, if they will not persist in unbelief, they will be grafted in again. There's nothing holding them back from being part of this tree again, if they are willing. He says, how much more will that tree take back its natural branches if it can sustain wild ones like you and me? How much more could it receive back them? It says that of those born of Abraham's line, they are loved for the sake of the patriarchs. That doesn't mean safe. That means he remembers them through the patriarchs and loves them. He says that in the end, the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophetic witness is that has been debated in the church. It could mean a number of things, but it's very clear that Paul does not believe his kinspeople have been rejected beyond hope. They will be restored in some way that might surprise us even. And that's why, as we look at what we read here this morning, it's relevant to us today. Jesus is facing the same kind of determined resistance to his identity that becomes crystallized in the Talmud and is still preached in synagogues today by some of our favorite people we listen to online. And this is why the proper response is to pray for these beloved people who share with us our human nature, a nature so endeared to Christ that he took it upon himself for eternity as a part of his person. Well, let's move on to the Christian faith. They read the scriptures, the gospels, and say, Jesus thought he was just a man. Does he now? How many men just go about reading people's minds and claiming to forgive sins when he knows full well that these Pharisees are right? Only God can forgive sins. He knows exactly what he's doing. If you want to understand Christ, stop reading him as a 21st century atheist and start to appropriate to yourself a first century Jewish faith. Then you'll start to understand him. But he is an example that real spirituality is not as we expect. Again, the real proof is not great numbers, or some of us are attracted to the most niche and eccentric and bizarre as a stamp of God's real approval. It's not that either. It's the fruit of the Spirit. Our last verse is 8 through 12. Immediately Jesus knew in his bones, which is easier to say to this paralyzed man, your sins are forgiven, or to say, get up, take your mat, and walk. But I want you to know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. So he said to the man, I tell you, get up, take your mat, and go home. He got up, took his mat, and walked out in full view of them all. This amazed everyone, and they praised God, saying, we have never seen anything like this. Is Jesus portrayed here as just a man? Is that what Mark is trying to teach us? Of course he's not. Mark knows full well what he's recorded, and he knows how it will be understood by his original audience. You'd think that this confrontation with the teachers of the law would be enough at least to spark some humility. And maybe for some it did. See this example where Jesus is fulfilling the Old Testament pattern of signs. God had laid out to the nation, in Deuteronomy in particular, that I'm going to send you prophets, they are going to be my mouthpieces, they will speak for me just like Moses has, and the way you'll know them is that they'll be able to back up what they're saying with my power. This is precisely what Jesus does. I want you to know that I actually have power to forgive sins, he says. So I will do the harder thing, at least in your perspective, and I will heal this man. My miracle is not something for its own end. It is a demonstration that I have the right to speak to God and that you should listen for life. Jesus gives this sign because he wants to make it clear who he is. If it's all well and good if they can say something that sounds like it came from God, it's all well and good if they can provide a miracle. But even if they do those things and then tell you to turn away from the Lord, in other words, if their fruit isn't there, they're still a fake. It doesn't matter about the power even. It's ultimately the transformed life of having union with God. Mark tells us that the crowd was moved by it. And ultimately, we leave this passage with them left wondering, what are we supposed to make out of this figure? Who is he really? What have we just experienced? And what does it say about everything we've ever believed about God? Lawrence Farley, I think, puts the obstacle well that we find in Mark 2 when he says the incarnation of God as a human being proves baffled follow. It's to this day the main stumbling block of Muslims, of Jews who do not believe, even of seculars, deists, whatever, throughout the last couple hundred years of Canada and the United States. It's the main stumbling block that Jesus could be human and God. So why have we received it? It's not because we're smart. It's not because we figured it out. It's because he so demonstrated himself that we trust what he claims about himself and entrust ourselves fully to him, which is what these other individuals are not willing to do. All of this happens in Jesus' hometown, which is ironic, but also not an accident. The hardest place to get people to believe you're God is probably at home. Well, unless you're an only child, maybe. I don't know. He does it in his hometown, and there's a mercy to this too. It's going to be hardest for these people. These are the ones who will say on numerous occasions, so it's hard for them. But Jesus will speak it nonetheless, even though it's offensive. He will offer them an opportunity to believe. So I leave with this question, and as I do, I'll invite up our worship team and our communion stewards. This question that Mark is asking you to this day through the pages of his testimony. Who is this Jesus of Nazareth? Not what is the Christian faith. That's to get it in the wrong order. Who is this Jesus of Nazareth? Because if you can believe his testimony about himself, then you can believe. Let's close in prayer. Father, I pray this morning that you would give us those eyes to trust fully in your Son. Father, there are so many and supplementary. Grant us the faith that Jesus Christ is indeed the Son of God, the Messiah, the King of God.